You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's date is the 2nd of November 2025. One quick thing. I want to advertise my Patreon page. My numbers are down. I think that has something to do with Apple, because they just recently bought it, I'm sorry to say. And I don't know how much more difficult it is to, we're charging $5, I guess, for something. I forget exactly. I don't really, you know, they can't leave well enough alone. $5 a month, I have, God, maybe 15 books worth of material on there. And a lot of it very miscellaneous, usually international relations and things like that. But now that Apple owns it, I have to be very careful what I put on there. Anti-Zionist stuff seems to be okay. Anything else, I have to watch myself. So I put the other stuff elsewhere. So these are, you know, insights that when I say them, no one's heard them before. 2 months later, people are talking about them and they seem to be coming true on the front page. It's the worst aspect of all this is that I do, my predictions usually come true for the most part, but no one listens. That's an old Greek I forget which one, ancient Greek curse. Anyway, please, I would like you to check out my Patreon page and please join it. My material on there is, usually what I do is I upload maybe 2 very long articles a month, maybe more, on everything from, you know, North Korea to Latin America to sometimes even things like music and the rest of it. I could guarantee you one thing, that it's never boring. And it's very unique. It's absolutely unique, as everything I do. Anyway, as far as the Orthodox Nationalist goes, we are going back to basics tonight, and I'm very, very pleased with it. It's nice. Sometimes I go off on a few other topics, not really connected with Orthodoxy. They always get it with nationalism, of course. With Orthodoxy or Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Serbia. And I enjoy doing that. But now we're back to the core of everything here. We're talking about the reign of Tsar Nicholas II and his role in the Russian Orthodox Church. And there's some new insights that I have that I don't think are very well known. We talk about Nicholas as a theological figure, as a political figure, as a royal figure, but his role within the church specifically, I haven't really spoken about directly. His contributions to Russian history are enormous, but one of them is his service to the church, and it's a neglected one. There's always the big if, you know, had the revolution not intervened, I'm convinced, many others are convinced, that his reign would have gone down in history. That's really the brightest time since the Muscovite era. He would have reunited the 20th century Russia with the pious Holy Russia of the past. I believe he would have connected with most of the old believers. I think it would have been Russia, to the extent, you know, was an industrialized power in certain places, but that would have continued, but only within a Russian context, not an internationalist one. Had Russia not been depleted of her best men through the savagery of both the First World War and the Bolsheviks, he would have accomplished something no other czar even considered. And that specific revelation is not spoken of at all, but we will talk about it later. The rector of the Ekaterinburg Cathedral, just before the war, was a priest, John Torozov. He said this, he talked about Tsar Nicholas relative to the church. He says, "What a great, inexpressible consolation to know and see that the sovereign leader of the Russian nation, to whom God has entrusted the destinies of our fatherland, places the foundation of everything in his kingdom, nothing other than piety. Personally giving an example of a deep, purely ancient Russian piety. Love for the splendor of church services, veneration of Russian shrines, care and zeal for the glorification of the great ascetics, and a holy, God-pleasing life personally. I got that from Talberg's book. Talberg I use a lot here. And there's a lot of symbolism here. You know, he uses the word nation, the foundation of everything being not just piety, but his personal piety. You know, he's connecting his person with the nation, something the Slavophiles should have put more effort into, but they didn't. And the same thing was said by Antony Klapovitsky, one of the great churchmen of this very same era. At the time, he was Archbishop of Volyn. He addressed the Tsar directly on September 3rd of 1912. In fact, he was there. The occasion was the consecration of the restored church of the Golden Dome Cathedral, St. Basil, in Ovruch, first built by St. Vladimir in 997. And here's what Metropolitan Anthony says. In the hearts of our people, you, sovereign, have no rival on earth, but only in heaven. Your Orthodox people love no one on earth as much as their Tsar, but in heaven they love the holy saints of God, those who, while in the body, live the life of blessed angels on earth. Can you imagine the joy of the people when they see with their own eyes these two fundamental attachments, not opposed to one another, but on the contrary, coincide? When they are gathering to venerate the holy saints, see among them their sovereign, leaving his capitals, leaving his palaces and everything else, and hastening to remote corners of the vast realm to venerate an Orthodox shrine. Such joys the Russian people are not just for today. In the dark days of their working life, they'll remember that mighty autocrat, their Orthodox sovereign, strives to share in the prayerful labors of his people, that he too delights his soul in the contemplation of divine sanctuary, that to him, like every simple village crusader, the most dear, beloved things are God's saints and their glory. So here you have two outstanding leaders, one a priest, the other one a great metropolitan, within the Russian church, demonstrating just how accurately they understood the inclination of their monarch at the time and what he really was. And generations of Russians founded, built, and defended, sparing no expense or effort, which of course were then squandered in 1917. Yet, we have to know these ideals continue on, and they can be found wherever any person who knows Russian Orthodoxy, those who remain faithful and devoted sons of Russia, whether they be ethnically Russian or not, they encompass a profound conception of the world, essentially Holy Russia, the Third Rome, understood not just by the mind, but the heart, a faculty far larger and more comprehensive than the mind. So many today, Russians, have no idea what I'm talking about. And yet, in the West, UK, USA, elsewhere, you have hundreds of convert communities come into being to both discover and defend it. Seraphim Rose, people like myself, of Anglo-Irish background, are telling Russians who they really are, because we were a part of it. As Klapovitsky himself said, it's not really Russia, it's not really an ethnic group, it's also a civilization in and of itself. But unlike other people, the Russian nation, which is a fairly young phenomenon, is the product of its church. There was somewhat of a pristine soil, the East Slavic pagans. The seed of Orthodoxy came from both Byzantium and Bulgaria, untainted by heresy. Now, when the Byzantine Empire collapsed, Russia was there to take up the mantle of the Third Rome, and the timing was extraordinary. Keep in mind, the concept of the Third Rome was rejected by both the Nikonian and the Petrian revolutions. The church gave Russia everything, physical and otherwise. Its language, the old Russian alphabet was created by St. Cyril Methodius, as you know, mostly for the translation of liturgical and other books on theology, history, and canon law. The church Slavonic language became the basis of the future development of Russian literature. Even the spoken language and written word. The baptism of Rus in 988 marked the beginning, and very rapidly did it flourish. One generation under Grand Prince St. Yaroslav the Wise, Kiev became one of the largest and wealthiest cultural centers of Europe, not to mention religious centers of Europe. But Kiev was not to last. The church revived the Russian state, sometimes by itself. It helped the small Moscow principality unite the Russian land into a powerful ethnic and religious unit, the likes of which had not been seen before that time anywhere. Russia had some handicaps. She was very large, unwieldy, very cold. Its growing season was short. Most of it, anyway, central northern regions. That means that its development required the full strength of all national, the full exertion, I should say, of all national strength and sacrifice under great leaders such as Saints Andrei of Sudal and Daniel of Moscow, others. I've been saying that since I was, you know, in my 20s. Russia took the form it did, among other things, because of its topography and the handicap that it had to suffer. You know, by those reasons alone. But between the 14th and the 16th centuries, the Russian state, Russian political idea, was based around the idea of service. The leading classes, so-called nobility, servitors, military servitors especially, served the Tsar and the state from their earliest years, as the law says, from their youth, starting about 16, to old age, quote, as their strength allowed. They served with a religious consciousness because their service to the state was service to God and the church. The state itself existed for one reason: to serve God, God's truth, God's church, and the laws of nature that God created. The Russians of that time saw themselves as obligated to serve the Tsar and the state selflessly. No personal agendas. In order to protect their country from the danger of capture by infidels or subjection by the state and different any group of people indifferent to good and evil. The development of a self-conscious orthodoxy. I'm misreading here. The development of a self-conscious oligarchy was the greatest political sin you could think of. And the monarchy was charged with stopping it. Above all, the leading classes considered it their duty to ensure for themselves and their descendants the opportunity to worship God in the specifically Russian Orthodox way, while observing all laws and customs. Russians at that time had no other goals in public life that were not legislated by the church. Self-interest was the sin for the Russian elite at the time. Again, it was the job of both the church and the monarchy to keep it in check. Because really, oligarchy is just self-interest run wild. Self-interest in an institution of rent-seeking. The spiritual life and desire to imitate spiritual leaders were central to the Russian identity. Who were these leaders? The great saints, among whom were revered St. Sergius, St. Cyril of Belozersk, the great metropolitans of all Russia, Saints Peter and Alexis, many others. With an inseparable close unity with them, the entire Russian people from that period, 14th to 16th century, that's the key to understanding the formula of Holy Russia and Old Russia. In Orthodoxy, each nation has a role to play. Orthodoxy has a strong ethnic component, legislated by St. Photius and many others. And the ethnic group has its own choir of saints that are specific to it. Now, Montenegrin saints are very different from the saints of Greece, of Byzantium. Very different. Saints of Byzantium had a professional army to protect them. The saints of Montenegro had almost no one to protect them. Very different sort of mentality. The concept of Holy Russia didn't imply that Russians were exceptionally holy, but only that holiness, struggle, and selflessness was the sole ideal for all subjects, doesn't matter what their station was. All other virtues, you know, heroism, culture, the rest of it, they were put in their place by a single, all-encompassing ideal of holiness. But it only had value, they were sanctified by their own behavior. But everyone's aware of our sinfulness. I certainly am. You are, and Russia was. The Russian nation then continually repented, professing its unity with their saints contemporary elders and the ancient ascetics, Russian and otherwise, recognizing their example and asking for their prayers and intercession. When I first got into late high school, early college, I loved the idea that saints could be anybody. They could be monarchs. They could be scholars. They could be ascetics. They could be very meek. They could be very assertive. They could be violent. They could be military leaders. It fits your personality, whoever you're drawn to. But the main representatives of the Muscovite boyar class and the service nobility of Russia, among them anyway, it was customary after completing many years of service to the crown, to the nation, they usually took monastic vows in their old age, hopefully to end their days in monastic solitude. That was an extraordinary cut. You didn't see this elsewhere. That was a Russian thing, how selfless the service of the state was, how boundlessly devoted to the Orthodoxy, to Holy Orthodoxy and their Tsar, and the Russian nation, in that order. That's what Holy Russia was. Subordinos, this almost a monolithic sense. They say monolithic in the sense, not that it's this, Leviathan, but monolithic in the sense that there really are no classes. There are classes de facto, but not de jure. Everyone's equal in the sight of God. Inequality is done as a matter of practicality and simply natural law. But the fact that the entire Russian nation, from the Tsar to the lowest peasant, lived one life with the same aspirations, it became very strong, that bond, both physically and spiritually. But after the brilliant flowering during the 14th to the 16th centuries, something happened. This growth, this flourishing came to a halt. And that was the time of troubles. A number of things happened roughly at the same time. The condemnation of Holy Russia and the old belief. The time of troubles and, of course, the reign of Peter. There's a profoundly accurate observation made by Bishop Nathaniel Lvov, I think. The most reliable sign of prosperity or decline on the spiritual level of a nation is the presence or absence of saints. And what he means is their canonization during any given historical period. There's a very rare icon of the Holy Women of Russia. It's written on the wall of the monastic church of the Epiphany in Kostroma. The icon depicts a procession of 33 Russian women, led by St. Olga, the House of Rurik, and they try to encapsulate in here the entire history of Kiev and Muscovite Russia. Bringing up the rear of this procession are the saints and the princesses Xenia and Anastasia. And the year of the icon is 1604. And that was the very same year where Juliana Morom, which is depicted third from the end, was glorified. This is extraordinary. After a 300-year period, though, of this kind of thing, it produced an army of saints that came to define the heart of the Russian nation. The 17th century proved astonishingly poor in canonizations. There's a reason for this. There were no saints proclaimed in Russia in the second half of the century. They existed, of course, they simply weren't canonized. Then Peter. His revolution crushed Holy Russia. But just like when we talk about the Bolsheviks, we're still begging the question when we talk about Peter, how was he able to crush Holy Russia? Maybe because, increasingly, those elites had become self-interested. But Peter was the first to raise his hand against Holy Russia. I mean, physically. The post-Nikon synods had condemned the concept of the Third Rome and the old Russian piety. But Peter was the first to physically try to undermine the spiritual roots, the 800-year foundation upon which Holy Russia had been built, destroying the unity between the sovereign on the one hand and the nation on the other. Very tough to restore. Naturally, spiritual wealth accumulates over a long time. But material achievements, that could be achieved in a short period of time. By subordinating spiritual progress to the pursuit of materialism and opening the doors wide to the corrupting influence of the West, which just means imperialism, Peter built a giant with the feet of clay, and it collapsed just a couple hundred years later. The 18th century was worse, as you all know. Peter abolished the Patriarchate, established the synod by royal decree. That meant that Russia was the only autocephalous church that didn't really have a first hierarch. But he laid these poisonous seeds. Eventually, the German Masons and Protestants took over. They bankrupted the country. Population fell. Then you see the development of the Masonic influence more generally. Things like the Decembrist uprising, the spread of nihilism, and from there, the terror that beset Russia pretty much from then on. I want to note that Peter the Great is a guilty man. I think he's an evil man. He was a revolutionary, an occultist. But you had many Orthodox scholars. You had the great patriotic boyar, Alexei Nechokin. He had developed, and there was many others too, plans for the modernization of Russia, especially in foreign policy. That was necessary, but totally consistent with Holy Russia. And he preserved intact all the features of the Russian way of life. That was not Peter's intent. An excellent book on that. Oh, it's in Russian. It's called by Vladimir Floria, The Foreign Program of Alexei Nordin Nechokin and His Attempts to Implement It. It came out in 2013. But people who want to defend Peter the Great, especially those who don't really know much about Russian history, they justify his revolution with two arguments. Number one, they say that there was an incompetence, in their opinion, of the Moscow army, led by incompetent commanders, the result of which, without Peter's reforms, Moscow could have become the easy prey for its neighbors. And number two, the extreme backwardness of Muscovite Russia compared to other European countries in terms of material progress, technical achievements, etc. And both of those are unfounded. The whole concept of backwardness was actually Petrine propaganda. Now, the Russian military might did not emerge overnight. And a glorious history spanning centuries, of course. The truth of the matter is that Central and Western Europe never quite realized that it owed everything it had to two empires and their peoples from the East. Byzantium, certainly, and Russia. Europe was protected from barbarian and destruction by the Russian Slavs, who bore the brunt of these attacks. But there's someone else. From the West, by the Spanish. I think there are some close similarities between the histories and customs of Russia and Spain. So from both sides of Europe, Byzantium, Russia, and Spain protected the central core of Europe from these invasions, so that they could prosper eventually, or, you know, develop oligarchies. The regular army existed in Muscovite Rus long before Peter. 1630, of course, was one of the first manifestations of the life regiment, Tsar Mikhail Fedorovich. Now, the second argument is the general backwardness of Muscovite Rus. It's factually false, and even if it were true, it's no justification for Peter's program. And a few authors point to modern Japan. Basically a feudal state until 1868, more or less ignorant of Western civilization, and for better or for worse, modern scientific and technological advances. But in just 35 years, Japan embraced anything useful and valuable this civilization. They achieved rapid development. They created a powerful army and navy, transformed its education and so much else, while carefully preserving its spiritual core, its political system, and national customs. But none of that was important to Peter. He was a revolutionary imperialist. He was a nihilist, basically. He was an occultist. As his holy, drunken, madcap synod, all this crap, proves. I've been through this so many times. One of these days, my Peter the Great book is going to come out. Even after the Second World War, they were brought to their knees by this inhuman genocide, carpet bombing of its cities, deliberately to slaughter civilians. Still, didn't renounce its spiritual heritage. However, the West understood that forcibly changing it wasn't going to work. Well, that'll be done through free trade and American consumerism. That will bring down any society. Well, except the announcement the emperor, the traditional understanding of the emperor was unfounded. We had to say that on the radio. I've dealt with these questions, Peter and modernization, to the point of saturation for 20 years. I don't want to get into it further. But this is key background information. And yet with all of that, the 19th century saw a consolidation, a rapid improvement in the life of the Russian Orthodox Church. We even call this maybe a golden age of church life and spiritual literature, especially. The violent westernization of Peter, or what he thought westernization was combined with the counter-revolutionary resurrection of Holy Russia and its understanding of the world. Remember, by that point, seminaries were teaching in Latin in Russia. Many schools of icon painting were totally westernized. You didn't have the eight-pointed cross. They were using the Latin cross. But that was soon to change. But within a modern environment, you had four long reigns. So that means stability ruled. That's the only way such an agenda could ever be pulled off. And we talked about the glorification of saints, canonization of saints. During those four long reigns, many saints were glorified. The feast day of All Saints of Ulin was established. Now, in Russia, the canonization of saints was a public and national phenomenon. Of course, it wasn't political, strictly, but it had immense political and social implications. From 1896 through, the terrible tragedy, basically 20 years of Tsar Nicholas, the Russian church canonized more new saints and established more church feasts than the entire 20th century, entire 19th century. It's interesting to note who was canonized. They have a lot in common. 1896, St. Theodosius of Chernigov, the Ukrainian, known for his stress on clerical education and the rebuilding of monasticism. Of course, Peter had banned it. Another one, 1897, Holy Martyr Isidore and the 72 martyrs with him. They were drowned by the Latins in Estonia for refusing to convert to Rome in 1472. Actually, at the time, it was at Livonia, but now it's in Uria of Livonia. That was established. The beginning of the 20th century, the great St. Job of Potiv, again, another Ukrainian monastic who wrote feverishly against both Protestant and Roman Catholic, especially Uniate, errors. These were all of national importance, great national importance. St. Job lived to be 100 years old, 1551, 1651. And like so many of these people, their relics were found incorrupt. So you have several Ukrainians here. The struggle seems to be, Russia, the Russian core against the world. Fighting the Latins. St. Job of Potiv also fighting the Latins and the Protestants. This isn't an accident. But then there was 1903. That many say, I think even Nicholas says, the high point of his reign, the incredibly popular glorification of St. Seraphim of Sarov. This was a massive national event. That took place in the presence of the Tsar, the royal family, the Dowager Empress Maria, many members of the imperial family, ridiculous numbers of clergy. Estimates at the time are about 300,000, usually peasants drawn from all over the place. Can you imagine this number at Sarov Hermitage? In Tambov province, a dense forest there, 100 miles from the nearest railway. And the roar when the Tsar came out, father and leader, was extraordinary. He was at a high for months after that. It was the actual physical unity of church, Tsar, and nation right there. Not just on paper or in theory or a political doctrine, but physically manifested. St. Seraphim had his relics transferred from the Church of St. Zosima, Slovki to Dormition. On July 18, 1903, that was the second day of the glorification. Now, his coffin was carried by the Tsar, the Grand Dukes, and several bishops. And the procession in the evening, both sides saw ridiculous, very dense rows of worshippers with lit candles. I mean, a number that they hadn't seen in one place before. The third day after the liturgy, Archbishop Dmitry of Kazan delivered a sermon, and he said this: "The secluded ascetic monastery had been transformed into a populous city. The always deserted, silent Sarov forest is now filled with excitement and discussion, movement and noise, but not the noise of everyday life. No, this is a mighty upsurge, an irresistible manifestation of the strong and healthy spirit of piety by which Orthodox Russia lives and breathes." Tsar Nicholas had his faith restored here. Not his faith in God, I mean his faith in his political mission. Wherever he went, he saw massive numbers of people who saw him as a father and leader. He was a very popular man. They all shared the same kind of intense emotions. Peasantry, clergy, nobility, whatever they were, unified, not around necessarily Tsar Nicholas, although it was, but also the holiness of St. Seraphim, who was quite sympathetic to the old believers, as we know. And it convinced Nicholas that any of the unrest, and this is true, the crisis of the nobility, any of these other issues, they were superficial. They were external. They were urban. Holy Russia was quite alive. And these hundreds of thousands of people, they're just the ones who showed up. Even made a stronger impression on the Empress. She had never seen anything. You know, imagine being in the presence of 300,000 people minimum. In the forest, in the middle of nowhere. The fervent passion, faith. No one had ever seen this before. It was exhilarating. Now, of course, she had to convert to Orthodoxy, but this is what made, with you know, no hesitation now. All hesitation was removed. It transformed her entire spiritual world and her entire being. So the Tsar, and I think quite properly so, because of St. Seraphim's Sarov's canonization, he became convinced firsthand that yes, there was a single, inseparable whole, the Russian nation with the great saints, and of course, the monarchy. Their shared aspirations for close cooperation in the organization of state life, if that were hindered, it would be caused by an artificially created barrier composed by alien elements, Jews. The Sarov Hermitage, the vision of true holy Russia, wondrous in its beauty, unfolded before them, the opposite of Jewish intrigue. Now, as far as the old believers are concerned, there were several canonizations aimed at them. June 12, 1909, the feast of Princess St. Anna of Kashin, who was the wife of great Prince Mikhail Yaroslavich of Tver, who was murdered by the Horde on 1318. Her presence in the calendar was restored. So this is like a secondary glorification. The report was proved by the emperor. Quote, "Throughout her life, having been a model Christian wife and mother distinguished by her Christian love for the poor and unfortunate, she demonstrated sincere piety, courageously enduring all manner of suffering." The Tsar took a very keen interest in her. They uncovered her relics July 28, 1649. You know, many centuries before this this occasion. 1650, her relics were transferred in the presence of Tsar Alexei, the Ascension Cathedral in Kashin. Now, after the Nikonian Revolution, the third successor of Nikon, which is the Patriarch Joachim, claimed the Council of 1677 and 1678, no feast day can be celebrated in her honor. Why? Because her fingers were folded to make the sign of the cross in the old way. You can't have that on display. Of course, before Nikon, the two-fingered sign of the cross was universal. I make that sign of the cross. But if that were taken seriously, the Russian church would lose all of its saints prior to Nikon. But that was perfectly acceptable. The schism was bad enough, but if this is really something that could be universalized, then none of the saints prior to the Nikonian era could ever be taken seriously or venerated in public. It was a stupid, absurd error. It can only be explained by the fanaticism of the Nikonians and the passions that this revolution provoked. So it was 260 years later, almost exactly, the reign of Tsar Nicholas II, to restore the feast of Saint Anna of Kashin took place in the city of Kashin itself, the Mystic Cathedral. By the way, according to the old rite, it was a big deal. Part of the purpose here was to bring some old believers back. It was perceived as a gesture of peace. And of course, all anathemas were either unenforced or simply lifted. Anathemas that were incredibly stupid to begin with, having no theological worth or content. We can't forget now in Belarus the holy relics of Saint Eufrosyna, the princess of Polotsk. She reposed in Jerusalem in 1173, brought to Kiev, pretty much her whole family as well. Her relics were transported from Kiev to Warsaw on the Dnieper, and then to Vitebsk on foot. Another huge crowd, thousands and thousands of people, the entire way with lighted candles, both sides of the road. There really is no estimate. 20,000, at each point, the numbers were extraordinary, especially for muddy roads. It's April. Here's what the Tsar said at the time, talking about her. Having piously completed the path indicated to her by divine providence, may this holy princess forever remain a bright guiding star for the entire Belarusian people, pointing out the truth of Orthodoxy, and may the spirit of her piety that was manifest in the unforgettable days of the transfer of her precious relics among the people who flocked in huge numbers to venerate the Venerable One serve as an edification for all those who in the vanity of life and spiritual confusion are ready to abandon the saving path of the true Orthodox faith. St. Eufrosyna was a princess, very literate. She brought many books in from Byzantium. I've never dealt with her specifically, but I have made allusions to her in the past. There's someone else, too. This is September 4th, 1911. St. Joseph of Belgorod, man of the 18th century, from the Cossacks. Another one. Huge crowd, estimated around 150,000 pilgrims. And St. Joseph only lived to be 49, but his relics had intensive healing power throughout the war, in fact. Wherever his relics went, you had monstrous crowds, especially soldiers. Empress Alexandra and the Grand Duchess Elizabeth donated very ornate lamps for the shrine. And in his report to the procurator of the Holy Synod, the Tsar said, through the gracious intercession of St. Joseph, may devotion to the ancestral Orthodoxy be strengthened in the Russian state for the benefit of all Russian people. I accept for the uncovering of the relics of St. Joseph. I accept the proposal of the Holy Synod with sincere tenderness and complete sympathy. I'm not saying these are necessarily political things, but they have powerful, that there's a reason certain people are chosen. Now, these men and women were already venerated as saints, so it's not like they're, it's not like the Roman Church. Whoever's, farthest to the left, they canonize. Now, Mother Maria, in Orthodoxy in the West, of course, that was purely political. I've dealt with her in the past. So many others. There was another one in 1911, the exact same thing. Eufrosinus, the male version of Sinozersk, was restored in veneration. This is now the second time after Anna of Kashin, that there's a secondary glorification of a saint that was excluded from the host of Russian saints during the reforms undertaken by Nikon. Nicholas had a tremendous sympathy for the old believers, but the great tragedy is that through some of these characters, many years ago, and then confirmed by Peter the Great, most old believers, were fairly moderate back then, but you had some extremist movements, the priestless and all that stuff, which I don't, a lot of the priestless were just because they were far away. They didn't have access to priests, but many of them were doctrinally priestless. Another big one, February 17, 1913. Hermogenes, Patriarch of Moscow and all Russia, starved to death by the Poles. In fact, during the time of troubles. The relics were glorified in Moscow. Again, a tremendously significant thing. And you can't stress, he was a patriarch. who was a patriot and nationalist who fought right along with all the Russian nation against the Polish invasion. That's extraordinary. St. Peter, the Bishop of Tambov, was accomplished in 1914, July 28th. Again, a ridiculous number of people. He was Bishop of Tambov. Peter was the first bishop of that diocese, and there was really nothing there. Dire poverty, the frontier diocese. Great illiteracy there. The pagans were the dominant element there. Certain tribes there, the Moravians, Medici, the dominant tribes there. You had Muslims and Tartars and a handful of old believers. Beyond that, you had fugitives and banished criminals. In other words, St. Peter created an Orthodox diocese out of pretty much nothing. He brought civilization to uncivilization. He brought order out of chaos in the best possible way under the monarchy. Maybe some of you are noticing that these men and women have a lot in common. Oh, and we can't forget Metropolitan Macarius of Moscow glorified the relics of St. John, Metropolitan of Tobolsk in Siberia, a relative of St. John Maximovich. He was also called St. John Maximovich. And he canonized him very explicitly as a sense, this time of trial for Orthodox Rus, and that's what Tsar Nicholas himself said. Then, of course, you had the death of the great archpriest John of Kronstadt, who during his lifetime was recognized as a saint. And in this regard, now this is a longer one, when he passed on, this is what the Tsar said about him. It was God's inscrutable providence, the great luminary of the Church of Christ, intercessor of the Russian land, the universally revered pastor and righteous father John of Kronstadt should perish, sharing with all of our hearts the people's great grief at the passing of his loving pastor and benefactor. We especially renew in our memory the sorrowful days, the final illnesses of our late father, Emperor Alexander III. When the fading Tsar requested the prayers of the people's beloved intercessor for the Tsar and the fatherland, now together with our people, having lost our beloved intercessor, we are filled with the desire to give a fitting expression to this shared grief of ours, and the people through prayerful commemoration of the deceased, annually marking the day of Father John's death, and this year timing it to the 40th day of the mourn event, being, both by our own spiritual attraction and by the power of the fundamental laws, the first guardian of our fatherland, the interest and needs of the Church of Christ, we, with all her faithful and loving Son, expect that the Holy Synod, standing at the head of this undertaking, will bring the light of consolation to the people's grief, will give birth to a living source of inspiration for all eternity, for future ministers and leaders of the altar of Christ, for the holy feats of pastoral work. That was an extraordinary thing to say for a man who has just died. Now, why did he say it like this? St. John of Kronstadt was an Orthodox nationalist. He was a firm monarchist. You would call him today on the far right of the political spectrum. He was not only a member of the Black Hundred, or the Union of the Russian People, I should say, but blessed their foundation, although he was quite far away from that. He was the most counter-revolutionary mind, probably in Russia at the time, but also a populist with a burning desire to help the poor and unfortunate. Kronstadt was this artificial slum of St. Petersburg, where people would be thrown if any foreign dignitaries would show up, you know, stuff like that. This is where people who would make the city look bad were pushed. And that's where St. John decided to work. I mean, John was not only present at the death of Alexander III, but at the request of the Tsar Nicholas himself, he also assisted in his wedding, in the Church of the Winter Palace in November of 1894. He was there at the coronation, the Assumption Cathedral, on May 14th, 1896. Tsar Nicholas continues. 100 years ago, in the ancient capital, within all Holy Russia, endured the difficult years of the invasion of 20 nations. He's talking about the time of troubles. The Orthodox clergy, enduring hardship and adversity together with the entire Russian nation, rendered great service to the fatherland, rousing in the hearts of the people, the valiant army, fiery faith in God, selfless devotion to their Tsar, and love for the church and motherland, humiliated and desecrated by enemies, the clergy, amid the horrors of death, fire, devastation, maintained courage and a strong stand for Holy Rus by kindling hope for God's swift intercession and assistance. Inspired words spoken by His Grace Augustine, the meeting of Moscow, blessed memory, the Emperor Alexander the Blessed, will remain forever memorable. God is with us. Understand, O nations, and submit, for God is with us. The Lord of hosts is with you, O Tsar. It could be the time of troubles. I'm sorry. I erred. It was another disaster that occurred later. He said 100 years ago, so this is, you know, 1894, 1896. Actually really connected to John of Kronstadt, so it's much later, actually. So I don't know, 100 years ago. Anyway, far more important point. These canonizations focused around things like national unity. Not just over time, but over space. And certainly the battle against anti-Russian forces. And most certainly national reconciliation on a nationalist basis. It's not an accident that these saints were Belarusian, Russian, and Ukrainian, bringing together three branches of Orthodox Russia. It spanned a period from ancient Rus to the 18th century, almost included St. John of Kronstadt, even though he just died. Nicholas is acting like he's, you know, already canonized, but he was considered canonized anyway. It included monks, bishops, laymen, women. It was a definitely nationally minded set of canonizations of men and women already venerated as saints, including St. John. Now, these weren't political canonizations, I'll say this again, but they did have immense political and social implications. Several references have been made to the old right. You know, I've always been sympathetic to them. I don't know if I could stand that long, though. Man, you have to really be born into it. Anyway, many of them seeking to bring the old right back into Moscow. And you had ethnic diversity. You had, you know, including a Cossack. That's how, you know, nationalists talk of diversity. You know, Ukraine, Belarus, Cossack Ukraine, and Russia itself. That's enough. But it was all about national unification under the crown. And these canonizations often centered around piety that brought order out of savagery. And the Temple of Diocese is one of the best examples. The concept of these two sort of indirect canonizations, restoring those two, rejected by the Nikonians. You think, yeah, they were really going to completely anathematize everything that came before them. Yeah, it was a revolution. They were revolutionaries. I don't think they saw themselves that way. But it's very difficult to justify their actions, the Nikonians and their followers. Anyway, beyond the canonizations, beyond that, Nicholas was focused on the church. He would love to be focused on the church. We'll get to this here in a minute. He wanted to be totally focused on the church. But his activities within the church itself were very broad. They covered all aspects of church life. Nicholas built and supported as many monasteries and churches as he could. Between 1894 and 1912, that 18 years, 211 new monasteries and convents were erected. Almost 8,000 new churches were opened, not to mention a large number of new chapels and prayer houses. Unfortunately, many of these didn't have long. The magnificent Fyodorovsky Cathedral in Tsarskoe Selo, that was a site chosen by the Tsar, the clearing right next to the park near the Alexander Palace, completed in 1912. The church had a lower church known as a cave church, dedicated to St. Seraphim of Sarov. This cathedral was built with a very close participation with the royal family, and it was financed entirely by them, their own money. Extraordinary interior decoration, especially the cave church. And that's why it was destroyed by the communists later on. Not to mention, there are 17 other new churches built in foreign cities. And the point was to make them icons in and of themselves, that you cannot look, you have to look, being so, you know, beautiful. And of course, the financial situation of the clergy. This was an ongoing problem. that had to be improved. Now, in connection with the imperially approved 1892 decision of the State Council regarding the appointment of salaries for all clergy without exception, Tsar Alexander III wrote to the procurator, of course, the great Konstantin Pobedonostyev, "It has long been my dream, deep conviction, that it is necessary to come to the aid and provide for the rural clergy. And now, thank God, I have finally succeeded my grandfather, Nikolai Pavlovich, began this in 1840s. I am only now continuing it." Under Nicholas, there are many other measures in this regard. He approved, as in 1902, he approved a charter on pensions and one-time allowances for clergy and readers. He says, "I am convinced the diocesan clergy will carry out their pastoral service with deepened zeal and a true Christian spirit." And he says this because when you're impoverished, your zeal, you know, because you're worried about so many other things, you need to be independent, as independent as possible, to carry out spiritual duties. Same thing for education. This education was a constant issue. Very much like Alexander, he was very interested in continuing to build and improve parochial schools. And I shouldn't have to tell you this, but the State Duma was fighting. They wanted to tear them all down. In 1913, those schools numbered about 37,641 precisely in Russia, and about 2 million kids were in them. Bishop Anthony Krapovitsky of Volyn, Metropolitan, he wrote in a lengthy letter written to him in 1905, that is to say, written to Pobedonostyev when he resigned. Here's what he said to him. "The education of the people in unity with the church began in 1884 solely thanks to you and strongly supported by you to the last day of your service. It's great, it's holy, it's eternal. It all more elevates you in the service of the church, the throne, the fatherland. Because in this matter, you were morally almost alone. You were not a reproduction or administrative routine, as pathetic and competent critics would call you. On the contrary, you broke new ground in life and everyday life. You took matters necessary for us, but before you, the administration had never known this. The first matter of parochial schools, you just took up and carried on your own soldiers. The second, bringing the theological school closer to the needs of the people, to the life of the church, you tried to fulfill and managed to make several strong contributions to the healing rays of the church and the national spirit." There were always consistent improvements in education. Theological educational institutions were separated into higher or lower, middle, and higher. Theological schools, the bottom, the seminaries were in the middle, and academies were at the top. So on the 300th anniversary of the House of Romanov, 1913, the Tsar, to emphasize the importance of the higher spiritual education, brought all of them, but especially the academies, under his personal rule. In other words, they were imperial academies now. That was 1913. God knows how that would have played out if he had lived. And obviously, we're talking about art, and singing was you know, concerning. These are not minor matters. Especially when Latin style icons were the norm, at least in the cities. I don't think people realize how Latin looking the mainline church of Moscow was. People like Alexander III and Nicholas himself, they realize that the old believers had a point. Look what's happened here. He founded the Committee of the Guardianship of Russian Icon Painting to bring icon painting back to what it was supposed to be, what we take for granted now. 1913, there was an exhibition of the ancient icons held in Moscow. But why did he do this? It's pretty important. We can't make Latin icons anymore. This is what it's supposed to be. Seminary shouldn't be teaching in Latin. Do you remember how highly intelligent Nicholas was? He spoke all European languages. He was invincible in debate. Of course, he always picked his battles. And he spent all of his money, personal money, on this kind of thing. All of this stuff was done for a reason. These canonizations, financing these artists, he was even very much into singing. Fully admitting that the old believers were right when it came to these practical matters. But again, we can't, Nicholas was so heavily involved, even just in artistic work. He spent a huge amount of money, his own money, on, for example, the production of church utensils according to the ancient models. Magnificent production of sacred vestments. Stuff like this that were returning to the Muscovite norm. And by that time, bell ringing had been forgotten. That was a very intricate part of Russian life prior to that. But even went beyond Russia's borders. Churches in Greece, Bulgaria, Serbia, Romania, Montenegro, Turkey, Egypt, Syria, I don't know, Abyssinia, Palestine, Libya, hold one, maybe more, gifts from the Tsar Maurer personally. Entire sets of silver gilded vestments, icons, liturgical books, were sent to dioceses all over the world. And he financed many of these, Serbian, Greek, Bulgarian, Montenegrin, and Antiochian. He financed many of these dioceses personally, since they were, you know, under foreign control. By the 20th century, of course, Serbia and Bulgaria were independent. And as I've said many times before, the Exarchate was 100% supported by Russia and by Tsar Nicholas. If you look at my papers and my lectures on that concept, the so-called anti-nationalist robber council of the Constantinople was just that. Philetus nonsense. Every church, almost every church of Constantinople and people under them supported the Exarchate, and Russia remained in full communion with it. But the Tsar was often alone. He alone stood up for the Orthodox Church in many places. He was one of the few that stood up when the Turks were massacring Armenians, started slaughtering Slavs, and he opened Russia's borders totally to refugees from these places. Now, a lot of foreigners think that the Russian Tsar was the leader, the spiritual head of the Russian Orthodox Church. That's not true, of course. However, as the ancient canons and doctrine lays out, he is the bearer of the supreme authority of the greatest Orthodox state at the time. That put a tremendous responsibility on his shoulders. He was the defender of Orthodoxy throughout the world. He saw this universal mission entrusted by divine providence to himself. It was a crushing burden. Power, if you have a well-developed conscience, power is awful. But those who know the scripture, familiar with the words of the Apostle Paul, many of you are familiar with this. In the Thessalonians, second epistle, for the mystery of lawlessness does already work. Only he who now restrains will not be accomplished until he is taken out of the way, who was removed, whatever the translation is. This is of extraordinary significance. He who restrains. Most of the church fathers saw this as referring to the Orthodox emperor. In this particular case, of course, much later, Russia, the descendants of the Roman Empire via Byzantium. Russian Orthodox Church rightfully and justifiably attributes these words of the Holy Apostle to the Russian Tsar, the heir to the Orthodox Christian Kingdom of Rome and Byzantium, ruler of the Third Rome, Orthodox autocratic kingdom. In that sense, he was a sacred figure. Successor to the special powers, the grace of the Holy Spirit, acting through him, restraining the spread of evil. And he was well aware of this role. Bishop Nathaniel Lvov once argued that the existence of Russia held the world together. In other words, a terrible worldwide outpouring of evil that engulfed the world after 1918 came to be because of the murder of Tsar Nicholas and the fall of the Orthodox monarchy. But as I've said many times before, Frederick Engels said, no revolution in Europe, or the entire world actually, can achieve final victory so long as the present Russian state exists. Now, that testimony is potent. That's how we know that our understanding of the restrainer is actually correct. The Roman Emperor is the restrainer. The Tsar struggled to return Russia to the unique path of Holy Russia, to revive its tradition, its Muscovite tradition, to restore its integrity, to recreate and strengthen the former unity between church, Tsar, and the people that had been lost in the Petrine era. These canonizations saw ridiculous numbers of people. The Tsar was there for most of them, especially for St. Seraphim. He knew the errors of Peter. He knew that there was a synthesis going on. I mean, he couldn't turn the clock back. But modernization was not connected with the acceptance of liberalism or Westernism. That's a falsehood. That's from the, you know, the inevitable school of Western political thought. He wanted the Patriarchate restored. He even wanted the capital moved back to Moscow. As difficult as that would have been. Tsar Nicholas had been interested in the restoration of the Patriarchate for a long time, studying it very carefully. It was a difficult operation. It's not just a matter of changing church governance. He wanted the synod abolished in that with the Petrine form, transfer of that authority to the Patriarch. In and of itself would have prevented, you know, could have been done very easily, but that reform on a grand scale was very complex. You're talking about the restructuring of the, really, most of the state structure on spiritual principles. This is why Peter did it. That's why Peter eliminated the Patriarch. It's not just, you know, offices and titles. It's the restructuring of the entire mentality of statecraft. He was also called upon to, along with his best elected official of the Russian land, the institution of the Zemensky Sobor, the representative committee or the council of the land. He wanted that to participate in the management of state affairs, not the Duma, not liberal democracy, but the same kind of Sobor that elected Tsar Michael. It would be a very difficult transition period. And what happened? The Tsar decided he was going to become Patriarch himself. None of this, the monastic life, none of that disturbed him whatsoever. It was a sacrifice. Sergei Nihilus, on his word, The Banks of the River of God, he wrote this while at the Optina Monastery. He recounts the following about his attempt by the Tsar to realize this dream. It was during the days of the severe trial of Russia's heart, the fire of the Japanese war. This tragic time, the Lord consoled her faithful sons by granting the Tsar's throne, with the prayers of St. Seraphim, the heir, the royal couple, a son of Tsarevich, Grand Duke Alexei Nikolaevich. The Tsar was then just entering his 35th year. Both were in the full bloom of strength, beauty, and youth. The calamities of war, the nation turmoil, and the state structure shaken by secret, in some cases open, ferment of internal unrest. All of this weighed heavily upon the Tsar's heart, like a massive burden. And yet, the disaster of Tsushima was still ahead. The church was a widow at this point. You had a massive, there was a regular support within the church for the restoration of the Patriarchate. Now, there's a story that a writer who I trust, E.E. Alfiev, who's written quite a bit on Tsar Nicholas and his work has been excellent. He talks about a young Ukrainian friend who was finishing up his studies as to be a higher deacon at one of the academies. The Tsar said the following: "I have learned that there is much talk among you, both in the Synod and in society, about the restoration of the Patriarchate in Russia. The question has resonated with me and has greatly interested me. I have thought about it at great length, familiarized myself with the current literature on the topic, history of the Patriarchate in Rus, is significant during the great troubles of the interregnum. I've come to the conclusion that the time is ripe. Not for Russia, experiencing a new turbulent period, the Patriarch is essential for both the church and the state. I believe that you and the Synod were no less interested in this question than I was. So what's your opinion on it? And if that's the case, then you have probably chosen a candidate for the post of Patriarch among yourselves. What if I see you haven't had time to choose a candidate yet, are you having trouble choosing? What if I suggest one to you myself? Then what would you say?" Tsar said, "By agreement with the Empress, I leave my throne to my son and establish a regency for him, consisting of the Empress and my brother Mikhail. I myself will take monastic vows and holy orders, and together with him, I offer myself to you as Patriarch. Do you accept me? And what do you say to this?" Now, who did he say this to? He said this to a group of graduates from one of the major academies in the capital. Now, the story I think is true because this is very much on brand for Nicholas. He always addressed the academy graduates. It was nearby, and this was the future of the church. Now, the graduates, they were in shock by hearing this. It was so unexpected. I mean, no one expected this anywhere. They didn't know what to say. They stayed silent. The czar waited a few moments for their reply, said nothing. Then he got up, he stood silently, bowed to them, and left. Now, that story has been around for a long time. It's been related by many others. And it's largely accepted as true, especially in Russia. It's on brand for him. It would be a weird thing to make up. But these young men, who were soon to be, well, I don't know what happened to them, but they were supposed to be, you know, bishops, and they came to believe that a great moment was missed then. Nicholas never pursued this after that. I don't know if it was from the lack of response from these graduates. That's another story. But from then on, none of the members within the Supreme Church Administration had access to the Tsar at all. I mean, he did his duty, you know, continued to receive them as needed, etc. But there had been a wall erected between them and himself. He always disliked the Synod. Now he really did. Thanks to what happened, either there or something like it, it was revealed the hierarchs sought their own in the Patriarchate, not in God's, and the house was left desolate. Now this comes straight out of Sergei Nihilus, On the Banks of God's River, Notes on the of an Orthodox Christian, Volume 2, Chapter 4, Tsar's Heart is in God's Hand, page 181, 183, and many of you have this because it's published by the Brotherhood of St. Herman of Alaska of 1969, St. Seraphim Rose's publication house. But he talks about this with many other people too. Count Dmitry Sheremetev. He spoke to a meeting at a March meeting of the Synod. They unanimously voted in favor of restoring the Patriarchate and then convening an all-Russian church synod in Moscow to do so. There was some objections. Had a handful of theologians and clerics. Disagreements arose, but the Tsar inscribed the following resolution in the Synod's report. Said the following: I recognize the impossibility of accomplishing in the present turbulent time such a great undertaking, requiring both calm and deliberation, as a convening of a local synod. I leave it to myself, when a favorable time arrives, following the ancient examples of the emperors, to set the matter in motion and convene a council of the All-Russian Church for the canonical discussion of matters of faith in church governance. That sounds vague, you know, but you know it's not. You know exactly what he's saying here. He addressed a letter to Metropolitan Anthony of St. Petersburg. He said, "Now I consider it entirely opportune to make some changes in the structure of our domestic church. I propose that you determine the time proper for convening this council." I got that from, that's in the Oldenburg book, very well known. Now, there was a pre-council conference. We've got to get the, you know, for the main sessions, soon began, and then World War I started. And then, of course, nothing happened. Outbreak of war, internal reforms had to be suspended. All the country's resources were dedicated on the war. But it should be noted, the number of significant reforms implemented since the coronation of Nicholas had surpassed the era even of Alexander II. Had the war not intervened, the reign of Tsar Nicholas would have gone down in history, the era of the greatest achievements achieved by the supreme autocratic power in Russia, maybe even in Byzantium. We know ultimately what happened. He was arrested March 8th, 1917. Probably the most shameful event in Russian history. He did not abdicate. We've gone through that at great length. He would never do that, especially as supreme commander of the Russian military. But he was arrested. He was first forced to be deposed. They wrote a abdication thing that he did not write, nor did he approve. And eventually, the provisional government seized power. Deeply Masonic. But when they took over, it pledged to ensure the Tsar's free passes to Tsarskoye Selo for the free stay of the family there, and if they wanted it, unimpeded travel abroad. Allegedly, in his abdication, he entrusted the new government to Prince Lvov. Allegedly. Now, members of the former provisional government then, when the Reds took over, fled abroad. That's Lvov, Kerensky, Guchkov, Milukov, others, all Freemasons. They were interrogated by the investigator N.A. Solokov. They conducted the investigation, the murder of the Tsar's family. Now, Solokov wrote The Murder of the Tsar's Family, that was published in Buenos Aires in 1969, and of course my own book on the topic, A Circle of Betrayal, Cowardice, and Deceit, an essay on the 100th anniversary of the ritual murder of the Russian royal family, which I published in 2018. The provisional government had already issued a decree on March 7th for the arrest of the emperor and empress, 1917. On March 8th, 1917, four Duban deputies arrived in Mogilev to arrest them. Prince Lvov's telegram stated that they would accompany the Tsar to Tsarskoye Selo. But as soon as the emperor boarded the train, these arrogant Masons announced to him, to their ally General Alexeyev, who had been informed the day before that the true purpose of their arrival, that he was under the arrest. Everything is based on deceit and lies. Absolutely gross. The Tsar arrived in Tsarskoye Selo on March 9th. He was met by a Colonel Koblinsky, installed as a new head of the guard there. He also testified in the committee under Sokolov. Many members of the Tsar's retinue were traveling on the train with him. When he exited the carriage, these individuals poured into the platform, began to quickly scatter in different directions, looking around, filled with fear of being recognized. I remember very well Major General K, no more identification, close friend of the Tsar since childhood, and I believe commander of the railway battalion, Major General Sabler, fled in this same manner. The scene was quite ugly. Of all those arriving with him, only one, Prince Vladimir Gorokov, the only one wished to accompany him. The Tsar, on the same day, participant in the so-called General's Revolt, the commander of the troops of the Petrograd Military District, previously designated for this position by the Duma revolutionaries and appointed to the Tsar as the last order, General Lev Kornilov, addressed the Emperor Alexandra and her children in Tsarskoye Selo by order of the illegitimate provisional government. Thus began the 16-month imprisonment of the royal family. Tsarskoye Selo, then to Tobolsk, and then, finally, in Kantarinburg, where they were murdered. Sokolov says the Tsar's deprivation of freedom was truly the guarantee of his death and that of his family, for it made it impossible for them to leave the country. The administrator of the provisional government, Nabokov, admits in his memoirs the act of depriving the Tsar of his freedom tied the knot that was cut in Ekaterinburg. I also want to point out that the British refused to accept him. If he were to leave the country and go to Britain, even though he was related to everyone there, they said no, assuring his death. So the British government had a role in his murder. Well, I think I've gone on long enough. Let me summarize it this way. Tsar Nicholas II was a very complex, but a truly spiritual and religious man. He had something, this rare combination of a very powerful will, contrary to mythology, with compassion. And that was coupled with a very profound and very subtle intellect. He was totally free of these traits. This is all comers say this. Imperiousness, arrogance, vindictiveness, pushiness. Sometimes those things are mistaken for firmness of will. Most people who knew him said that his distinguishing features were modesty, spiritual gentleness, extraordinary kindness, nobility, fidelity to his word, spiritual delicacy, a careful attitude towards the pride of others, and responsiveness. You can never take those for weakness. But of course, Machiavellians always will. But he also knew when circumstances required to exert authority. He had to pick his battles like anybody. He had to command, directly and boldly express his displeasure in a stern and decisive way, but always in a calm and polite manner. He was a Stoic. He was simple and welcoming to most people, but there were boundaries that his royal rank forbade any overstepping, and he made sure people knew that. He was very concerned with his own constant, persistent self-improvement. He developed a tremendous Stoic self-control, never openly expressed his emotions. He was tenacious, persistent, resilient and unbreakable, steadfast, calm, and his will was unwavering once he made a decision. On the day he was forced off the throne, the precise words of the Tsar allegedly were, "All around me is treason, cowardice, and deceit." That's why I titled my book that. And on top of that, he said this treason was for him a very unexpected, a treacherous blow, shot in the back from people who enjoyed his boundless trust. A terrible blow that he could never foresee, he couldn't eliminate, he couldn't prevent. He was a very private man. He didn't open his heart to anyone except Tsarina, I'd say. She knew the depth of his soul. Many of his confidants didn't really know him. But ignorance bred misunderstanding. Misunderstanding often leads to misinterpretation and even condemnation, which in turn serves as the source of false rumors and gossip, repeated in the Jewish media, and from there spreading to wider circles. Well, that's a very nice way of putting it. I took that from, well, actually several sources. But no, it wasn't misunderstanding and misinterpretation. It was deliberate hatred. They needed him destroyed. And they hate him even now. But this nonsense, this is how the legend of the weakness of Emperor Nicholas II was born. And of course, like everything else that people think about the world in this country, it's a lie, it's falsehood, it isn't true, it isn't real. The typical American middle-class normie lives in a fantasy world. He really doesn't know anything. So people like me, people like you, are condemned to a very different kind of a life. Thank you, my friends. Thank you for listening. If you've made it all this way, and I will definitely talk to you next week, God willing. Goodbye.